This is Donna Fiducia, co-host of Cowboy Logic Radio, and you're listening to America's Web Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition today. We appreciate you joining us, as always. Today, my guest is Jim Nadeau. Am I pronouncing Nadeau correctly, Jim?
Yes.
Okay. I'm always concerned that I pronounce names correctly, and I wanted to make sure that I was getting that right. Jim owns Nadeau Land Surveys in Portland, Maine, and he's joining us today to have a conversation about a number of things. I was thinking, I don't think I mentioned this to you, Jim, when we were talking earlier, but I assume you probably know my friend John Swan, who's up there, up your way.
He's just a few miles down the road.
Yeah. Yeah, John's been really active in NSPS through the years, and most recently was actually chair of our foundation, and he just stepped down from that last year. I assumed you probably knew him. In my visits to Maine, I find that the community of surveyors there is pretty small, similar to the one I grew up in, actually in Virginia, where everybody kind of knows everybody. So that's sort of a good thing, I think, when people do get to know each other and are able to share information.
Absolutely. I view all the local surveyors as friendly competitors. I think the profession in general just becomes much stronger when we team up and share data and help each other share the information that we all can't always get for a particular job.
That's true, and I can remember, of course, I've been doing this obviously a lot longer than you've been involved, because my very first surveying job was almost 50 years ago. But back in those days, I don't think the camaraderie was quite as good, at least in the rural area where I was working at the time. It was almost like everybody had their own thing. And instead of caps back in those days, you know, we put the caps on now with our company name or our license number or something on them. Every surveyor used a different color flagging for marking property corners, which could get a little confusing sometimes. But it is good to have that collaboration. There's no question about that. And building a business model, and I know that's one of the things I want to talk to you about today is the model that you have undertaken in managing your business. And then, of course, one of the primary things we want to talk about as the visit goes along is the Welcome to the Flood Zone website that you've set up, which I think is a really, really cool thing, and I wanted our listeners to be sure to know about it if they didn't already know about it. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about you and your background, how you got into surveying and developing your company, what your goals are.
Well, thank you. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. Excited to chat here for this hour. One of the things that we've always done here is we are a business and we really try hard to have goals, a mission statement. We try to put our clients' needs in the forefront. We try hard to be aware that we have to change because of technology. I think back when we first started, or I got licensed in 1993, we used to do a lot more topographies and construction layout. And those types of services, because of GPS and the construction industry, we've lost that. And I think that as we try to move forward and grow and, more importantly, survive, I do think surveyors in general, like most other industries, have to change with technology or we get left behind. We do have GPS now. We've had it for about, I'd say, 5 years. And it was one of the purchases that dragged my feet a little bit about buying them. And then as soon as I bought it, I was quick to say, what the heck took me so long, because it was such a nice piece of tool to eliminate level loops when we're doing elevation certificates or do one-person topographies if the conditions were correct, etc. So a willingness to change and move forward has been a big part of our business model. I do think that surveyors in general, we're not the greatest communicators with our clients. We've taken a lot of time to explain to clients what they're getting, or more importantly, probably what they're not getting. Because if you tell someone that you're not getting something, I think generally they assume they're getting it. So we've taken a lot of time to emphasize that component of it. Along with that comes trust in the communication, and I do think that trust actually brings value into the particular job or project, and therefore I think or believe, and we have done successfully, we're able to charge more because we are giving a lot of value, but it all starts with getting the client to understand what they are getting from us.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Educating them is certainly an important role there. Have you found that with all the newer technologies we have, use of websites and social media and those kind of things, is that helpful in your situation and being able to educate, or does it still kind of boil down to that personal contact?
I think websites and our newsletter that we put out has helped quite a bit, that Welcome to the Flood Zone that you had mentioned. We have, I would say, approximately, in excess of 6,000 followers now on our newsletter. For the concept of putting a marketing budget together, if you just had postage for that newsletter, it would exceed $3,000 a month. So it's a great way of reaching out to people every month to remind us that we're here. I know that we had talked prior to this the show about our website. We've taken a lot of time to really educate the breakdown of what's needed for a boundary survey. Really helping just educating the public about what we really do. I do believe that because you can buy flagging and a cloth tape at a hardware store, the general public or a lot of people believe that they can do what we do. And we have a very unique set of skills that everybody relies on, but they don't realize how in-depth or how knowledgeable we really have to be with math and law. And I do think by conveying that out to them through those forms of vehicles, of course, sitting at a conference table and explaining to them and giving them the time in answering their questions is also valuable as well. But I would say it's multi-tiered in getting that information out to them.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I was intrigued is probably not the right word, but I was impressed with when I looked at your website originally is how well you had laid out things for people to find out about what it is they're actually getting from you. You know, what is a survey? You mentioned that earlier, and then there were a number of other things on your site that I thought were pretty impressive, too. And those are good lessons, and I'm sure a lot of our other listeners and practitioners out there are using similar techniques. That's one of the things that we struggle with here sometimes about in terms of having something on the website specifically similar to what you were talking about. One of the difficulties about doing that from a national perspective is what they get is not necessarily the same thing everywhere. And so that creates a little bit of a challenge from the perspective that we have. It's maybe a little easier to do that from the from the local perspective.
Yes, absolutely. And we've learned to be better at qualifying our work or our education as we leave the comfort of the industry area that we practice in, because we do know laws and requirements change. But, you know, generally the education component should be used more as a guide to get a consumer to understand what they're up against, and then they speak to the local surveyor, and that surveyor would specify or identify actual needs. I just think a lot of consumers really don't appreciate how much we are really capable of doing. And that, to me, I think in a lot of ways is the surveyor's fault by not taking time in communicating that. I think that's okay, but surveyors aren't that ready to do that. And I wish as an industry nationally, surveyors communicated better what we did. I know for years when I used to go to seminars with my peers in the room, I was very cautious of raising my hand in front of them in fear of getting sort of beat down because of the knowledge or intelligence in the room. The guys and gals who are licensed surveyors, they know their stuff, and we should flex that knowledge a little bit more with our consumers, because I don't think they understand how much we really do need to know.
Yeah, that's true. I guess when you said they know what they have, it kind of brought the thought to my mind. Know but share, you know, sort of like the, was it Reagan who said, trust but verify. Knowing is great, but if we're not sharing what it is with the people we're serving, then that it makes it more difficult when you are trying to provide something for them. So I would agree with that. I know you said, I believe you said you were licensed in 93. So what was your background? All of us surveyors have a different story, although sometimes very similar stories, about what drew us to the profession.
Well, that's an interesting question. I actually started at the city of Biddeford, which is about 15 miles south of Portland. I started at Town Hall in the engineering department. My reason why I went there was in high school I did architectural drafting and really had a flavor for drawing and drafting by hand. That was probably where my love brought me into this realm of expertise, and then I decided I wanted to be an engineer, which quickly turned to surveying, because what surveyors do out in the field or process data was much more interesting for me than what engineers do with the data. So I started as a draftsman thinking I wanted to be an engineer, but I ended up as a surveyor.
Yeah, that is a pretty similar story, and I can relate to the high school experience, although in the Backwoods High School I went to, there were no architectural drafting classes, but I always enjoyed that, and I actually thought that's what I wanted to be, too, as an architect. And I always recall in a physics class once, I had finished an assignment, so I was sitting there drawing a house, and the instructor came by and looking at everybody's paper, and he saw what I was doing, and he looked at my drawing, and he said, "Be sure not to put too many windows in that house. It makes them too hard to heat." So he gave me a break that day. But nonetheless, I think your story is somewhat similar to a way a lot of us got involved in the profession. And I think that makes it even more important for us to continue to learn. And that's hard sometimes when we're doing our everyday job, that's for sure. But and maybe we're almost time for our first break here, so I won't get into this, but I'd like your thoughts on the whole continuing education thing, because it is important that we continue to learn. I know I hear a lot of people from time to time say, is the system that we're using now actually accomplishing that, or is it not? Is it simply just checking off boxes on a form or something because we showed up at a workshop somewhere or something like that? So I'd be interested in your perspective on that when we get back. So let's go take that first break, and we'll be right back.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com, and thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Quick steaks are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden steaks, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Steaks, go to www.quicksteak.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
This is Donna Fiducia, co-host of Cowboy Logic Radio, and you're listening to America's Web Radio, a most eclectic mix of conservative shows.
Welcome back today with Jim Nadeau, Nadeau Land Surveys in Portland, Maine. We were having a discussion before the break about our beginnings, and I'm always interested in how people begin what they do. One of the things that you had provided to me when we were sharing information back and forth, I thought was a very interesting statement and an important one, and that is that you're not a land surveyor who owns a business. You're a businessman who is a professional land surveyor. And I think that's such a critical element of what we try to do, because sometimes it seems as though folks don't really take the business part of it into account the way they should, and which means if you can't keep the business going, then no matter how good you are, you're probably not going to be able to serve people. And I thought that was really important. And I don't know if you want to chat about that a bit or not, but I do when we get through that, I want to get your thoughts on the whole continuing education thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm very passionate about the concept of running a business than being just a surveyor who has a business. The mindset changes a lot. I do think that other businesses are geared for growth and profits to allow to give raises or keep the valuable personnel on staff that you want through the years. There has to be something there in excitement to keep those people on board with you, and I do think that's attached to a vision, a road to get where we want to get with excitement so they can buy into what we're trying to accomplish here. I think that the flood component that we've implemented over the last 4 years have done that wonderfully for us, but we need to be going somewheres, and you know, the old cliche statement is, if you don't know where you're going, you're not ever going to get there. I was very stuffy about goals in general for years, and then I realized that they do have a unique and irreplaceable value in an organization. And once you stop buying into goals and accomplishing goals, there's a momentum that's created that makes coming to work that much more fun. I dread thinking that we just make widgets because that gets tiresome, and we want to be able to change and create new ideas that we can offer to our clients.
Yeah, that, you had mentioned another thing that I think is really important, and that's openly discussing weaknesses and strengths. I've been in a number of companies through my life, owned a few of them too, and that's such an important element of having that open dialogue that includes everybody, really.
Yeah, we don't have, nobody's ever wrong in this office. We are all wrong, or we're all right. We actually check each other's work pretty extensively, and we buy into that. There's no fear of getting screamed at or embarrassed, et cetera, because we all buy into everything that leaves this office. We do it together, and what happens with that is that we're able to work on each of our weaknesses, because I'm far from being the strongest in everything that we do. I have wonderful staff here. We take advantage of the real strengths of the others in the office. We're able to check each other with different perspectives or insight. So by the time our product leaves the office, we've done our best effort as making it as perfect as possible. And of course, perfect is nearly impossible, but we try real hard as a team to team up and get that done the best way we can. So what happens is we leave the ego and insecurities at the back door or the front door, and we come in and we're friends and we work together to try to do it the best way we can together.
Do you have several licensed surveyors in your office, or is it just you or a couple other people?
Right now, I have two others. They are both different in personality, but they're both fantastic in what they do, and they're able, they sit right next to each other in the same office, and they share ideas often, and it's great to hear them say, I didn't think of that, or that's a good idea, because those channels are open. Because I literally say that in an interview when I bring someone else on board, is that if you're not going to be able to work as part of a team, I need to know that, because then I probably won't hire that person regardless of how much credentials they have, because they need to be part of the team. It just works for us very well.
So do you have teaching mechanisms set up for your other employees as well? Or I know I've always found that to be helpful, and some people do, some people don't.
We do have teaching. We all team up and help anybody new come in. We make sure that they know that they need to ask questions, and that is the way they're going to learn. I will put any one of my employees in school for AutoCAD classes or any other classes that they want to self-improve. I will pay for that because I certainly believe that what I get back after they're that much more trained or quicker, I get that back very quickly. And we do engage them into our meetings slowly, not to overwhelm them, but get them up and running. Probably the biggest thing that we do in the office is we try real hard to make each one of our members very diverse. It keeps them easier to it's easier to keep them busy when the weather's bad or we might be slow on a particular concept. But that diversity in skills helps a lot, and that's probably a big part of what we emphasize in training, so they understand the whole process.
Is there an educational system that's a source for employees, like through community colleges or something like that in your area? I know some people are able to draw from that, and then other parts of the country, it doesn't exist. So I was curious if you had that source as well.
We have a wonderful program up in Orono, which is about 3 hours away. It's an engineering type program that you can have much emphasis in surveying. There is a local community college here that does AutoCAD, offer various levels of AutoCAD. I don't believe anyone can stay in the profession and grow or have more value unless they can do AutoCAD well. It's just the way we prepare documents now, but that's close by. That's just down the street.
Yeah, I have some pretty good friends up at Orono. Knut Hermanson's a really good friend. And so is Harlan Andrud, actually. Harlan was in Blacksburg at Virginia Tech during the years when I was there, not in school, I was in business there, but I got to know him really well, he and Steve Johnson, when they were there. And they're good folks. That's interesting. I was just at the Five-State Conference up in Vermont a few weeks ago, and I was talking to Knut about, we were discussing the difficulty of maintaining one of the programs and in the schools because, you know, typically surveying programs aren't research programs, so they're not bringing in those kinds of dollars, and our numbers aren't really great. And one of the comments he made, which I thought was really nice, really good, was it's difficult to convince the bean counter, so to speak, that having a small program where all of your graduates have a number of job offers is better than having lots of students, none of whom can get a job. And that's something that school and others have done pretty well, I think.
Right. I actually had dinner with Knud a few months ago after I was coming back from a teaching stint up in northern Maine, and we chatted about that whole concept of business as part of the surveying education process. And, of course, he agreed and made sure that he makes sure that whole business component of running a business is part of that education process, which I was really happy to hear that we don't want to just go in there and learn how to process data, but there is another component of this is running the business, and Orono is very good, and they understand that value as well, which is very good.
Yeah, that's true, and actually that gets back around to what we chatted a little bit about, or started to talk about, but before the first break on the continuing education side. Of course, when I think of Knut, he's been doing that for years as well, and we used to see each other all over the country doing that kind of thing. But I've always been one of those people who believe that business should be a big part of the continuing education process, business classes. And I know some of our state licensing boards don't think that's such a great idea, but I've always thought it was a good idea, even for those of us who are already in practice.
I totally agree. I'm probably on the aggressive side if asked for an opinion on continuing ed. Most states requirements for continuing ed is very low. I would literally double. If you really break it down, we don't learn enough through the course of a year or two. I do think that putting business continuing ed credits as part of getting licensed again, that would be a nice addition. I know that in a few meetings that I've done, surveyors tend to think that, well, it's really the same old stuff all the time. It would really broaden the scope of what could be offered for continuing ed. That would help keep the surveyors away from being a little bit more bored, I guess, but the whole business component of making budgets and being efficient, charging more to lower liability because you bring more value, that all comes into the business component. So I'm very pro increasing hours, and it should include business classes as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I do hear the same thing you're talking about from people all the time. It's like, well, why do I need to keep doing this things over and over and over again when there's lots of opportunity to expand that if we're willing to do it?
Right. A GIS is a great example of that as far as the willingness to change, or GPS. The flood component that we've exercised here out of our Portland office has been a very pleasant surprise. I thought it would be a good idea, but it's proved to be better than a good idea because of all the disconnects that are in the flood program. But thinking of new ways to serve your clients is a great idea.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're 30 seconds or so away from break, but that's really a good because I do want to talk about the flood component and what you guys have been doing there and in particular the newsletter that you've put together, because everything I've seen, it's really good information for people to see, and I see you've developed a relationship with the Floodplain Managers Group, which is a great group of people, too. I've been able to deal with them at the national level some, and I really like working with those folks. So let's go ahead and take our next break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Thanks.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to schonstedt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
Hi, I'm Ray Bowman, hoping you'll join us each Friday at noon for our new show, Food and Farm, brought to you by FeedstuffsFoodLink.com, only on America's Web Radio.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstedt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstedt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back again, everyone, on the show where we do our Parker Davis Quick Stakes contest for the day. Everybody knows Parker Davis Quick Stakes is a sponsor of the show, and they sponsor a little contest every week, and the person who responds to Quick Stakes contest at America's Web, AmericasWebRadio.com, with the answer first is the person who wins for the day. So, Jim, the question for the day is, if you'll respond, is, again, what year were you first licensed?
1993.
1993 is the answer we're looking for in today's Parker Davis Quick Stakes contest. Thanks, Jim, for participating in that. As we were going to break, you were talking about, or we were talking about, the whole continuing education, how there are lots of opportunities to expand that education beyond the normal, that thing that we kind of see from pretty much everywhere. And I've not been in continuing education classes or around them in every state, but pretty much every state. And I agree with you that there are lots of opportunities, particularly on the business side and business opportunities side, that somehow gets lost because of the idea that competency only exists in the technical aspects of what we do. But certainly competency should be a part of our business acumen as well. So that makes perfect sense to me. And perhaps that you've done, and maybe it's a good time to get into the website a little bit and talk about how that came about and how it's been developed and where it's headed.
Sure. The big component that we've added to our organizational list of services is the area of flood. We've been doing elevation certificates and letter map amendments for many years. Perhaps 6 years ago, in speaking with lenders or realtors, title companies, homeowners, it occurred to me that if an elevation was higher or lower, I wasn't really sure what it would do as far as being beneficial or not for a homeowner. And I guess at that time it bothered me that I didn't understand my numbers, though I felt the elevations I were putting on the elevation certificates were correct. I didn't really know what they meant, and I really got into the whole flood program. Over the last 4 years, I've received three national flood designations, one as a floodplain manager, one that's based out of North Carolina as a floodplain surveyor. Though I can't use that in practice, it gave me an education level that was very unique, as well as being able to market that as well. And then the last one I got, which was the difficult of the three, or the more difficult, was the designation in flood insurance, because it is a flood insurance program. I needed to understand programs and insurance options better, because then we can offer solutions and options to our clients.
Yeah, you and I were talking the other day about you coming to, and I'm not sure what the proper terminology is for the place up in Emmitsburg, and you'd been going there and getting some of this designation and actually just getting education. That was a pretty interesting story about dealing with that. And then on the CFS side, the North Carolina thing, you know, we started that program with Gary Thompson down in North Carolina years ago with the intent of taking it to all the states eventually. But FEMA, when ELOMAs came along, as a matter of fact, I was talking with the FEMA guys on the radio show a week or so ago, they determined that they didn't think we needed to take it to other states. I think kind of discounting what you just said about, even though you couldn't use that certificate where you're located, it was still a great educational opportunity.
Absolutely, and I knew when I went down to North Carolina that I could not use it here. And just to clarify, the CFS, depending on the LOMA submission, if you are a CFS in North Carolina, you're able to actually do the LOMA process.
Correct.
But I knew that would be the logic of sort of what the wizard was doing behind the curtain to understand it. I chose to take it as that mentality. But behind my name has definitely given me some representation that's unique. So I'm actually going down. I have to go down every 2 years to get recertified. The other attraction of having the CFS is being that North Carolina is the pilot program state, and they have flown their whole state more or less. They have one-foot contours. I believe most of the state has BFEs for all their water courses. They're on the front end of technology of what's coming up the pipeline or down the pipeline as far as changes in mapping in the program. It's very interesting to stay ahead of the curve as well. So being a CFS is quite interesting.
Yeah, that I don't know if you know the total genesis of how that program really got started, but it was right after Hurricane Floyd pretty much destroyed North Carolina. And Gary Thompson, who is in the Department of Natural Resources there and a former NSPS president, worked with FEMA to get this education going at the same time they were doing all the original mapping that you're talking about. I think they may have mapped it once or twice more since then to get the data even more current.
It's,
now, you were talking about I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you were talking about the floodplain manager. Maybe you could, I'm sure surveyors have heard that terminology, but I'm not sure if they understand what it entails, actually.
Right. The floodplain manager certification, I actually went down to Rhode Island to test and pass that, and it really pertains more to the program as a whole as far as what the roles are of everyone that's participating in the program, the community's role, the whole purpose of the program, how to read the maps, how the maps were created, really gives you a very good understanding of the program. You do not have to be a licensed land surveyor to be a CFM. I don't believe you have to have any professional license, but you do have to pass that exam in floodplain management. And that was the first one I got, and that gave me a lot of momentum of understanding maps and the disconnects. Unfortunately, the program, I love the program. I think it's very well thought out, but because it's such a big program, there's disconnects. I did go to a national conference in Hartford a few years ago, and I can tell everybody that the program is in good shape at the higher end with the people that lead the program. I do believe people on the lower end as myself, the boots in the mud type soldiers that become the centerpiece of speaking to lenders and realtors and code offices, municipalities, homeowners, engineers, other surveyors is we need a lot more of those for the program nationally, because that's where the program is really going to kick in and get a lot more respect than it does. I think there's a lot of disconnects that become emotional for people that don't understand the program as well as they should.
Do you think that if we had more surveyors who actually pursued that would help in that effort?
Absolutely. I think what we're doing here in Portland, surveyors in any part of the country, we're just taking time to understand the program better, educating our clients with options and solutions. For example, I probably get, I have a couple, three lenders who call me whenever they have a question about compliance with the program. I had a realtor call last week who wanted to know if I could rate a premium for a homeowner, and of course I can't, but whenever they have a flood issue, they think of us now because we're very diverse, and what we've done in diversity, anyone can do, but we've taken some time to really learn the program well, options and solutions, why elevation certificates are proactively a good idea as you transition to a new map. I think that there's a big disconnect that when a homeowner's collateral of the loan, the building gets horizontally scaled into a flood map or a special flood hazard area, that the insurance agent wants an elevation certificate to rate the building, but as often overlooked is the lowest adjacent grade, that I do believe that there's a lot of homeowners that have been horizontally scaled in that should not be in, and then on the flip side, there's a lot of people that have not been scaled in that have actual risk in the storm, because I do believe that the maps lie a lot, And a lot of people think that the maps are telling you what actual risk is, and it's really just telling you perceived or perceived risk per se, or predicted risk of what would happen in a storm. But it's very different than actual risk, because actual risk you can't really measure because of the conditions of being able to measure and collect data accurately when the storm is actually occurring because of cloud cover or conditions on the ground. I think that's a really big disconnect that the program has, that the maps really just show that predicted risk and not actual risk, though many people do think the maps are showing actual risk, and that's a huge problem that I think the program, if they were to address that better, that would help calm emotions down better.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because it is, if you don't have all the information you need or the expertise you need, that's easy to see where that could be the case. We have a minute and a half or so before our next break here, but you had mentioned to me, and we can follow up on this when we come back if you like, but you had mentioned to me in attending the workshops and the events up at the Emmitsburg site, and perhaps other places, were really instrumental as well in terms of oftentimes just the people you get to interact with.
Yes, absolutely. A wealth of knowledge at EMI.
And for those who don't know, EMI is Emergency Management Institute. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes, it is.
Yeah. And as I said, now, is the only place they hold those kind of things at the facility up here at Emmitsburg, or do they do that other places as well?
They do them at other places as well, and if you went to the Emergency Management Institute website, you could see where they are offering them at other places, at satellite locations. I've yet to take a satellite location class, but I've been down there a couple times for advanced floodplain concepts. I go down at the end of this month to do instructional delivery for subject matter experts, because we've been doing a lot of teaching on flood zones, and I realize that...
I hate to interrupt, Jim, but we got to go to our last break. We'll pick up with that when we come back.
Okay.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
This is Denise Simon. 18 hours a day, I live in a world as an intelligence analyst. What I find is reprehensible. What I find is terrifying. What I find is treasonous. The mainstream media has completely failed the American people. So join me for the Denise Simon Experience every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back today with our last segment with Jim Nadeau. Again, Jim, thanks for being with me. Before we went to break, you were talking about EMI and some of the advantages of what you get from that, and I kind of cut you off there at the end. So if you want to follow up on that a little bit before we get into the final topic.
Oh, yes, sure. EMI, the Emergency Management Institute in Emmitsburg, Maryland, usually houses or the students, the big majority of students are actual government officials that go down. The government officials are engineers, planners, regional directors, state plan coordinators. Sitting in a classroom of those also being students, the wealth of knowledge or the uniqueness of which angle they come in for the program based on their own needs that job descriptions force you to think different in the paradigm that we have in our thought or our needs for the program. It's very, you walk away there with information that you're not going to get anywhere else, because the students are actually probably in most cases more intelligent than the instructor in ways. But the instructors themselves, one gentleman, I forget his last name, his name is Marty, he actually created the early 1970s HUD maps. He's been in the program for 40 years, so I would just love to have what's in his head about the program. They're very unique knowledge down at EMI.
Seen a lot of transition in his time, hasn't he?
He sure has, yes.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you were able to inform the audience about EMI, and I think I mentioned to you, I had been up there a couple of times myself, not for that particular training you're talking about, but more related to my duties here. But found it to be a very intriguing place, and like you said, you meet so many people there from different backgrounds that are all related to this somehow. You just learn just by being around them.
Absolutely.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying, and they're all so willing to share their information, so it really, nobody's guarding their information, so it's very, it's very fascinating what you can get from those classes down there.
Now, when we started out the show, we were talking about the newsletter, and so let's talk about it a little bit. It's called Welcome to the Flood Zone, and just talk to us about what you try to cover there.
We try very hard to keep our followers up to date with the changes that are occurring in the program. My office manager, Nikki, starts the newsletter off every month. I do a monthly message from Jim that is what is my monthly flavor of that I want to really try to drive a little bit more in detail. But it's real important that Nikki starts off with it because of she's actually getting very competent in flood. But she keeps it simple in the sense that it doesn't become real technical for the followers that are interested in the newsletter to be able to understand what we're trying to get for a message. We try really hard, and we've done very well. We don't use it in marketing or sales. We don't pitch ourselves. We really try to make our newsletter an educational tool, which has really worked quite well in that whole business model thing, because what it does is it actually builds trust that we are not trying to make a pitch. We're just trying to help, and that is what a consumer wants. So the newsletter has really helped that way. We really do just try to help people understand the program better.
You have a pretty wide listenership base, too, which I found very interesting, because it brings a lot of different people together in a sense that they're all seeing the information with the diversity of your readership.
Yeah, we don't know how many states we cover, but this past week, our last four subscribers were New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Tennessee. So it's out there because of it's also on our website. It's reaching out much further than Southern Maine, which is very unique. And that actually keeps us, as you had mentioned earlier, very cognizant of making sure we're saying things that are more correct at a national level, because it's definitely leaving Southern Maine pretty quick now. So that keeps us sharp in thoughts, that's the intention, of course.
So is the content driven by events or by changes as they occur in the regulations, or is there any particular driver for it, or is it just pretty much whatever's happening at the time?
Probably a little bit of both. We spoke about BW-12, the Bigger Waters Reform Act, and then the Homeowners Affordability Act, how those changes were going to impact. But there's a lot of 101-ish type information that causes the disconnects, that the initial flood determinations are just horizontal scaling. Maybe that insurance agents are not looking at the lags as well, that a lot of the maps were made from quadrangle maps or map projections, so there's going to be error in there, that as we transition from the current paper maps to digital, some folks have done that already, but the vertical datum has changed from that NGVD 29 to NADD 88. Here in Maine, 88 is about 6 or 7 tenths lower in elevation. As you go down the East Coast, that number gets larger. But when you get over to the West Coast, I believe 88 is higher than 29. So that's real important because of budget constraints in the program, that I think that when people see the DFIRMs, they'll see the base flood elevations changing. But we need to make sure, is it new data, DATA, or has the datum, DATUM, changed, and it's just the same information that has been moved over to the digital ortho image, but it's the same data that was there years ago. Really what we try to drive is that if I had a preference, these would be called flood insurance rate guides and not maps, because the word maps, I have a problem too, because no one questions the accuracy of the maps as much of what underlying data is there that creates the maps themselves. And I do believe the users need to understand that in some cases the maps, the data that's underlying is quite weak or old, or is being just transferred from the old maps. You know, with technology and LIDAR, and there is a budget to fly higher populated areas, but more rural, there's a good chance that information is the same from the old maps, and that's okay, but people need to mitigate more than worry about exactly pushing the envelope of the base flood elevation, but be conservative and understand sea level rise and erosion and these type things that are happening with the earth, that we need to be conservative and get out of Mother Nature's way.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that cavalier attitude is not the right terminology, I don't think, but perhaps just not focusing as much on exactly what's entailed when we in the surveying community are dealing with this and we're making assessments or statements about this. That actually can carry quite a bit of liability with it, can it?
It sure can, yes. And probably the place that I see the most liability for everybody, and I pick on realtors a bit, and I guess because I am one as well, but I try to attach value with risk, which is another big problem that the program has. But as we move from the old maps to the new maps, we also need to know that the architects and engineers or designers or planners need to keep an eye on where we're going, even if the maps are in preliminary phase, because if risk changes, then design is going to be inappropriate. So there's a lot of things that are happening that the people that are involved or the stakeholders need to understand, that the flood program is really the elephant in the room, and don't miss the elephant in the room, because there's a lot of ways that a bad call with flood is going to diminish value and bring foreclosures or lawsuits as we move forward. So it's serious stuff to not overlook.
Very true. And we got about 3 minutes left here, but one of the places I think that comes into play, one of the things that you had written down and what you sent me, was the typical attitude is, if I'm not in, the map's right, and if I am in, it's not right. And so there's always this tennis for people to want to be out so they don't buy flood insurance, but at the same time, if you're the person helping them make that determination, you need to be certain of what you're actually doing.
Well, it starts with understanding that the maps are predicted or perceived risk, and they're not doing actual risk. I believe there's 25% of all the claims happen outside of the flood zone. People need to understand that these maps are not accurate representations of how Mother Nature is going to behave when the storm really does come. I think it's convenient that if you're not in, then I don't need mandatory flood insurance. But the understanding of what the maps are trying to accomplish for regulation at communities and for the insurance agent to set a premium based on perceived risk has nothing to do with what actual risk actually exists on the site. That's probably a huge component that just isn't spoken enough about the maps.
And that's really good information for our listeners to know as well. And I really appreciate everything that you do and appreciate you being on the show today, first of all, because it's been it's extremely good conversation and very informative for our audience. And really appreciate what you do with the website as well. And I hope more of our listeners will begin to take advantage of that, because I think probably among the things you said, one of the most important for us to remember is that what those maps actually are, being that projection and not being something that's hard and fast, so to speak, and it requires some level of for effort to go beyond that and just not be at face value, so to speak.
I think the word mitigate or mitigation is the powerful word of the day, is that the maps will always lag behind a little bit, and we need to behave better and respect Mother Nature and kind of get out of her way.
Very true, and that's, we've got 30 seconds or so left, so maybe the word of the day we'll tell our audience is mitigate or mitigation as regards this, and I would encourage everybody to go to the website. So let everybody know before we have to go what the website is.
Yes, it's www.nadeo surveys.com.
And with that, we're at the end of our hour. So again, Jim, thanks so much for being with me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.